Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to our panel discussion. We've got an excellent panel for you this afternoon, and I'm going to do my best to chair it, which means that I want to get them to speak as fluently and precisely about what their interests are, and then get a conversation going between us, which we hopefully will be able to put out to you, and you can come back so that you feel involved. You're much too close to not be involved. So I don't know, people at the back. I don't know. yes, that's right. I'm Jeremy Aikman, and this is Eileen Daly. Eileen Daly is my partner in crime. We're involved in publishing the writings of artists, and we're in partnership now with the Tall Tales people because they're busy with telling stories. And really that's the theme, I think, that we'll pick up on most, is this idea about stories. Whose story? How do I get my story? How do I tell it? You know, what am I trying to say? Amongst other things. Let me introduce you to the panel. There's Carol Segal is the Freud Museum director, and we'll be hearing from her first. She'll give us a bit of background about the Freud Museum and the collaborative projects that they do with artists, because they've got an excellent history of working with artists and do some really inventive, innovative things, which I think is quite special. Not every open museum like this is able to be so free or generous with the way they use their space and their artifacts. I think it's quite important to flag that up. It's a couple of artists, Una Grimes and Rachel Goodyear. Una's work you might have seen is the potatoes on Freud's desk. Notice them? They're sort of toasts.
Yeah, toasts.
All sorts of funny little objects dotted around. Not so funny, art objects. Very pardon, sorry. First gaffe of the afternoon. Now, be more careful. Rachel's drawings.
Those are the pictures.
Ah, yes, of course. Right? Yes, of course. Well, yeah. Well, really, Una has the whole gallery behind her. Yeah. Rachel's drawings, some in pieces, separately framed, and some on one piece framed coming up the stairs. You can easily see that they are characters in a narrative or a whole narrative. You can easily see and start to make up stories in your own head about them. Rachel will enlighten us more. And we also have Dr. Cleo van Velsen, who's consultant psychiatrist in forensic psychotherapy. That's quite a mouthful. I'm still trying to digest what that means, but I mean, it's a really fascinating area of work that Cleo van Velsen is involved in, and her contribution throws a very interesting curve on the art and the thoughts around this discussion conversation this afternoon. So I'm going to invite everyone to speak, but just give us a 10 minute, and then we'll see if the panel wants to pick up on anything each panelist has said. And perhaps also, if you've got a burning question, and there's one or two of you, we can also field questions as we go along. But if you can just poke up a finger into the air, and I'll catch your eye, and I'll make sure to get you. If everyone wants to have a question, then we might be in trouble. So we'll see how it goes. Okay. So I'll start with Carol, please.
Thank you, Jeremy. And as Jeremy said, I'm the director of the Freud Museum, London. So I wanted to open by just putting really the Tall Tales exhibition in a little bit of context, just giving you some background information about other exhibitions that have been here at the museum and why the Freud Museum is so interested and enthusiastic about working with contemporary artists, and a little bit about what we think the programme has brought to the museum, and perhaps vice versa. Just briefly the actual museum itself, although I suspect that most of you know this. We've been open as a museum for 30 years. This is our 30th anniversary this year. And the core of our collections, obviously, are Sigmund Freud's possessions that he brought with him from Vienna. This is the house that he and his family, including his daughter Anna Freud, who's also very well represented in the house, came to when they escaped from Nazi-occupied Vienna following the Anschluss in 1938. And Sigmund Freud was unusual compared to most refugees, either from Nazi-occupied Europe or refugees since, in that he was able to, A, settle somewhere and was welcomed somewhere else, and was also able to bring with him so many of his possessions. And so here in the house, you know, the core of the house, I say, Sigmund Freud's study with the iconic psychoanalytic couch, his desk, his collection of over 2,000 antiquities, his library, and so on. He died about a year after settling here, but his daughter Anna, who was herself a very innovative and respected child psychoanalyst, continued to live in the house until her own death in the early 1980s, and it was her wish that the house become a museum. And as I say, it opened in 86, 30 years ago. So what the museum has tried to do since then is both obviously, interpret the legacy of Sigmund and Anna Freud, but also become a sort of centre for discussion and debate, and particularly on the kind of role of psychoanalysis in contemporary culture, film, theatre, and so on, and art. And for over 20 years now, the museum has had a programme of working with contemporary artists who have installed a whole range of kind of displays and exhibitions here over the years. And if any of you are interested, in fact, if you look at the museum's website, there's an archive of all the exhibitions that have ever been held. And it's a pretty impressive list. So, you know, artists from some of the early ones, people like Susan Hiller, Sophie Cowell, and then more recently, we've had Noble and Webster, Matt Collishaw, Damian Ortega, Miroslav Balka, you know, a lot of well-known names in contemporary art. And the criteria that we, you know, use in order to sort of agree to an artist exhibiting here is that it should be somebody who has an interest in some aspect of Sigmund Freud's work, Anna Freud's work, psychoanalysis, and who will respond in some way to those ideas in the work that they produce for the house. And most of the exhibitions are site-specific. They are work that's produced specifically for the Freud Museum. That's not always the case, but certainly usually at least an element of the exhibition is something that has grown out of getting to know the house and its collections. I thought I'd just take you very briefly through a couple of our previous exhibitions to give an idea of the sorts of things I'm talking about. But just one other point I'd like to make before doing that is that one thing that's very interesting for us running the museum is the response of visitors. And one of the difficulties that we have, this is something that we might want to discuss a little bit more, is it's all very well for us in the museum saying we really are welcome and are intrigued by the way the artists respond and sort of the development of psychoanalytic ideas in people's artworks. It's often something that visitors to the house actually find quite bewildering, antagonising, often quite hostile to some of the work that's here. A lot of response we get from visitors is, what on earth have you got all this? Oh, you know, modern art. I didn't come here to see modern art. I came to look at Sigmund Freud's couch. And so a lot of the work that we're trying to do as well is trying to kind of explain a little bit about why we feel that the work of artists can actually deepen the experience of the visitor, particularly if you're trying to understand some aspects of psychoanalysis and how it works, and the kind of response of artists can be very important. So I just very quickly take you through a couple of... Actually, I was just going to start with this because it's a nice subversive piece that a few years ago, in fact, it was not long after I'd come here, and it was quite a kind of baptism of fire for me. This is a Mexican artist, Santiago Borja, and he used some Native Americans living in Mexico to weave a different carpet to cover Sigmund Freud's couch. And it's the idea very much of bringing the other into Sigmund Freud's study, and particularly non-European cultures and so on. Personally, I found it a very kind of powerful piece. There was outrage amongst a lot of people that we could dare to remove Freud's original carpet and use it to cover the couch. So I think that kind of gives an idea of what I was talking about. But just to take you through, and I just took the theme, you know, makers and scribblers, because I sort of went for some of the scribblers, really, of the exhibitions as I'm showing you. And also, I thought there are three women artists. Again, as we're sort of coming, you know, Tall Tales is an exhibition of women artists, picking out some of the women artists who've exhibited here before. And I said when we were discussing yesterday, I haven't done a count, but actually I think possibly the majority of artists who've exhibited here have been women. And I want to now go back and have a think about that and what the reasons are. You just as well, you might be interested that Jo Mora, some of you might know, an academic from Central St Martins, has actually been writing a book on the art exhibitions at the Freud Museum, and that's hopefully coming out later this year. And she has some very interesting things to say about the themes that have been picked up, the way different artists have responded to the house, and particularly the way they've responded to it as a sort of site-specific way. The first exhibition, I would say, probably the best-known artist we've had here, Louise Bourgeois, and that's rather different. I haven't said that it was site-specific. Actually, this exhibition came after Louise Bourgeois had died, so obviously she wasn't creating new work. But there was something particularly interesting. This was 4 years ago, 2012, and again, some of you may know, there's a large cache of Louise Bourgeois' writing about her own psychoanalysis was discovered late in her life. She'd always publicly been very hostile to the idea of psychoanalysis. It was then revealed that actually she'd had 3 decades of Freudian analysis, and these large boxes of thousands of notes, lists, drawings, writings, and so on were discovered, which were her responses to her own analyses. And so these form part of the exhibition. And you can see the kind of the mix of, you know, the writing, sometimes French, sometimes English, drawings, and so on. And that was the heart of the exhibition. And then again, showing how the Freud study is often so central to how people exhibit. There was her work, Janus Fleury, which, you know, aspects of the, you know, male and female genitalia, all sorts of other resonances hanging directly above Freud's couch. So you can see what a kind of resonance space that can be. The next artist that I wanted to just show was Alice Anderson. And again, some of you may be familiar with her work and have seen the solo exhibition that she recently had at the Wellcome Collection. And much of her work, Alice herself is very beautiful with long red hair, and a lot of her work relates to using this red hair, or not real red hair, but synthetic red hair, as part of the work that she produces. And the exhibition here was called Childhood Rituals and was very much about her own relationship with her mother, delving into her past, her childhood, and using the memories of that to create an exhibition which included actually winding these skeins of red hair around the whole house. So, I mean, that was, again, a very dramatic use of the Freud Museum. There you can see it being installed and these kind of cables of red hair around. We have very patient neighbours who are usually very enthusiastic about the sometimes extraordinary things that appear in their midst. And inside the house, this was the Anna Freud room, in fact, as it used to be, with Anna Freud's loom. We don't actually have the loom there anymore, but you can see again the way that Alice used both images of herself and the red hair, the copper hair, and she wove that, and the kind of again the echoes of weaving, Anna Freud's weaving, to create her own artistic and response to her memories of childhood. And the final one that exhibition that I just wanted to highlight was actually the exhibition which was on in the house until last week, and some of you may have seen. And this is Emma Talbot, another artist who very much uses experiences from her own life, her autobiographical experiences, through her work, which is a series of both drawings and textile work. And here, again, Emma had worked very hard within the house to produce work that really did respond to this particular site. And this piece was actually a very beautiful set of silk curtains which hung downstairs in the dining room, the room that you come into and go through to the shop, which were both kind of dream sequences, a whole series of dream sequences and words, and the words were all quotations from Freud, mostly from the interpretation of dreams. Again, in the study, Emma produced a work which went on the couch, and I'm not sure if I have a picture, yes. This was another piece in the study, again kind of referencing the carpet, the textile element, but using, again, a mixture of words, images, drawn images, to create a very beautiful screen panel that was in the study. And just the final piece of hers that I'll show was this on Anna Freud's couch next door. The exhibition was called Unravel These Knots, and the knots of kind of psychoanalytic work and the need to tease out and untangle memories, emotions, thoughts and so on very much ran throughout the exhibition. And here we have on Anna Freud's couch a patient, Anna Lizanne, lying here, and again with a kind of knotted work that was, as I say, very much part of Emma's exhibition. So I think I will stop there and say this was really just to kind of give a little bit of background to the context within which Tall Tales is working.
I pick up very much from that, Carol, your little phrase there, stories that deepen experience. I like that idea. And I was thinking, you know, whereas a static museum can fossilise history, and we already see how the couch is the sort of revered relic. Various people. So, did you have couch fear?
I had a couch fear, yes. Not the potato, no couch potatoes. That'll come afterwards, I hope.
Yeah, but how you spoke yesterday a little bit about how you felt slightly intimidated in the space. But I mean, but
what is that? It's a legacy, yes. Yeah. I think with any place, when the interesting bit of being invited to respond to any collection or archive, the good bit is all the research. Yeah. You have the time and the opportunity, and it's like a starting point. And then one can spend months sort of in libraries or archives digging up all sorts of things. The problem is then what you do with it. One can have too much, as we call it, research, which can sometimes mean just watching a whole lot of films. But actually I think this place has been very welcoming and accommodating to all of the artists here, and I think all the shows I've seen, and again, the shows again have been so excellent, but we'll see, that'll be up to the audience to tell us whether it's working well.
Okay.
They've been very supportive so far.
Okay, won't ask them yet. Let's save that for a minute. Please.
I want to say, well, because of the title of the talk, I want to say, as a born and bred drawer and scribbler, nice to know I'm in such sort of esteemed company. One felt very much a loner in that sort of...
Shall we reiterate the title of the talk?
The title.
Because I don't think we
have... Carl mentioned
it. Yes, I think it somehow managed to get slipped past the scribblers bit. But could you say it?
The whole thing? Yeah. That's your title.
I can't remember it.
Fear, desire, everything in between, something like that.
Sounds pretty good.
Okay.
So, born a bread, born a scribbler. Also, I'm about flattest, in love with pattern and paper and all things bookish, ranging from Japanese woodcuts to Winsor Mackay, good quality graphics, illustration, design and packaging. My practice has always been very deeply rooted in a sort of badly behaved, disruptive narrative. Perhaps from a sort of childhood habitual drawing on the back of storyboards and a sort of lifelong drowning in cinema. I'm always plundering sort of narratives gleaned from such diverse lives as Mary Bell, Fred West, William Bly and Bob Cobbing. For Tall Tales, I'm showing three double-page spreads behind you from Flann's Architectural Digest. So it's Freud meets Flann O'Brien on John Huston's film set, because there was a film of Freud made in the 60s by John Huston. They explore the illusionistic portrayal of architecture in The Third Policeman, combined with my missed memories of a summer spent on location. The sort of joy, the magic of seeing what was behind those elaborate sets, all the gaffer tape and sticking together things, the staple guns, and the badly behaved relationships of the cast and crew. They were like a sort of completely sort of Freudian knot of social gossip. I started by sort of pogoing off the Chinese memory screen on Freud's desk downstairs, with a sort of misinterpretation or deliberately bad interpretation of Freud's screen memories theories, by literally drawing screens and hoarding film screens and hoarding boards, onto which I projected a brood of deconstructed houses seen in the back. They were the houses, all the houses I'd ever lived in, sort of cocktail shaken into a sort of dream consomme. The drawings are in conversation with a collection of playthings. There's, in the vitrine opposite, there's I Things Flat and I Things Lumpy, which became a sort of optician's cabinet of discarded props. I mean, obviously with anything, they were made as simply as children would make glasses out of old loo rolls, out of almost anything, out of packaging. And obviously lots of connections with seeing, muffling, not seeing, hypnotising, Montgomery Cliff's cataracts and all sorts of references. None of which I was absolutely deliberately conscious of when I was making the works. And downstairs, there's a choir of potatoes quietly invading Freud's desk. Toes and toes lounging sort of slovenly on his well-ordered bookshelves. And together with Jerry's lunch, they form a sort of tribe of cartoon-like amulets. For me, the drawings are a sort of investigation into language, into beginnings and ends of it, learning it and losing it, children starting to speak and people with Alzheimer's and dementia losing their power of speech, memories and misinterpretation. And clay for me is the instinctive makingness that sort of fills in the gaps. Together the drawings and the clay things are a sort of celebration of dumbness, a sort of transformation of static objects and a sort of simmering consomme of fact and fiction. They're like Hanna-Barbera meets rationalist philosophers on the analyst couch. Or, as Beckett said, clay, the form that accommodates the mess.
Oh, good. Okay, well, only your fantastic word play, I think, we also get feeling of that. And, I picked up on what you said there about disrupted narratives. I mean, that's all of us, isn't it?
I think so.
Yes. Does anybody from the got any thoughts or questions I'd like to come back to you about Una's potatoes or this in sort of subtly subversive, invasive thing that one is doing there with
it. Yeah, I was curious about the positioning of toes and toast in front of the books, and it seemed to resonate with what you were saying about dumbness somehow, and the kind of almost, I don't know, where the couch potatoes are kind of invading, you said invading the space, and very much belong, they belong there. I think it's a double table, although I had seen them before somewhere else, so I wasn't even unfamiliar with the work, but they very much belong. Whereas the toes and toast, it was like obstructing language, obstructing the knowledge, and not, you know, sort of resisting that kind of, academic engagement.
Well, again, the celebration of dumbness, they're like the guardians of the gate, and here they become like the, and again, every time they've been wherever they inhabit, they take on a different reading. But this one, I was quite amazed that they sort of sat there alongside all the other objects, which again, put in front of the books. I can't bear anything on bookshelves, decoration put in front of books, I can't get to the books. So again, it's that the barrier.
Within the museum context, we can't get to the books. It was like a play on that.
But then again, I felt like that sort of, not consciously, but afterwards, it's like the screen, whether it's a film screen or whether it's a film flat. It's about what's behind, you know, it's what's hidden and sort of, you know, concealing and revealing.
I feel that one's quite able to make interventions which are either going very nicely, fitting very nicely, or can bounce off quite hard
awkwardly,
you know, in ways which most artists give their behind teeth to get a reaction out of something that, you know, so well. So, something to do with the very religious feeling of the building and the artifacts, and almost as if one is trespassing on somebody else's religion. By
trespassing, but also respecting. I think there's, you know, it's a very.
I'm going to do the line age with film, because in the way psychoanalysis and film are the same age.
Yes.
And Gabbard, there were two brothers in America. One is a very famous psychiatrist, and his brother is a professor of film studies, and they wrote a book together about psychiatry in the cinema. But one of the things that has come out is the sort of importance of film in a way when it's not sort of over-consciously trying to show something, but actually unconsciously gets it right about how people work. So I like that sort of link of yours with the filming and the analysis.
Good. I'll leave you to it. Yes, you know, I have a love of film and from a personal experience of it too.
You didn't mention that perhaps we can come back.
No, on location, I did mention being where Freud meets Flann O'Brien on John Huston's film set.
Yes, sure.
And my mismemories of being on the film set.
And
all the sort of gossip that was going on.
Yes, I think that's
stories.
Important to know that you were, as a child, you were on those film sets.
So you're both inside, and we were always cast as sort of extras, give us something to get us out of the way when we were children. And it always ended up on the cutting room floor, so it's a story of my life.
Okay. So now I can introduce Rachel Goodyear, please.
I think I have an image in there. I'll just bring up.
I'm sure rather than that, I need to get some technical help.
Well, I'll just bring up one of them actually. They're just really fast from there.
Technical interlude.
I definitely fall into the scribbler's category. My main practice is drawing, and the tall tales I have, the piece Thought Spill on the Stairs, which is a group of drawings, like 34 drawings, and then Mole Hills, which is like a large drawing just on the other side of the stairs, and then two smaller pieces in Anna's room, one's a little sculpture. My main practice is drawing, and I tend to think I never really think of any of my drawings as sketches. I always think of like everything that I do as fragments. So you'll have like these like really, really raw drawings. It's like right up to this, like these kind of larger, more elaborate, more detailed pieces. But these are some details from Thoughtspill, and that's Thoughtspill is one of my most raw pieces of work. So these are very much say the kinds of drawings that are just kind of scribbled down or kind of that happen quite quickly. So there's something very, very immediate and raw about them, which is what why it just felt so appropriate for this show and for this space in particular. And the way that I work, it's really a mixture of observations, things that I've overheard, things that I've read about, things that's just constantly just gathering up information. So in a way, I'm kind of rearranging the world around me and just collaging all that information, just gathering it all up and then looking for little combinations of things, like rearranging things, exchanging characteristics or exaggerating things. And I'm never really trying to tell a linear narrative. I tend to use narrative as a way of communicating ideas, of kind of fears, desires. This Thoughtspill is a particularly important piece within my practice because it actually contains pretty much all the themes that run through my work. So when you kind of look at the individual pieces, you'll find things like things emerging, penetration, drooling, oozing, growth, death, tangling, apparitions, and offerings. And my work kind of tends to have this combination of this kind of very tense kind of balance between like the playful and the sadistic. And I tend to kind of look a lot at kind of relationships between things. So this idea of getting across a sense of precarious relationships or struggling for this like balance of power. I tend to kind of like leave this balance kind of quite open as well, because I do like to have room for the viewer to actually respond to it in their own way as well. So I'm not trying to prescribe, it's like, this is a feeling about pain, this is a feeling about whatever. I like to kind of like leave it open so the viewer can actually like sort of make that decision themselves and actually kind of continue and respond to it in their own way. And so it's like a lot of that is like left open for the viewer. This is like referring to like molehills, which is like the large drawing on the other side of the stairs. This is kind of one of the more kind of maybe sort of like overtly sort of slightly sexual pieces of work, but it's still within there. It's very awkward. It's very tense. So it's kind of almost like looking at the absurdity of just like sort of like rituals that we have. It's like how we communicate with each other, how we find a partner, how we. It just like the whole sort of absurdity of being a human being and communicating and all the awkwardness that comes with it. And I think I won't actually kind of say too much because I think a lot more will actually come out through conversation. So.
Are you seeing that in the work? Are you finding that? Seeing those pictures? Did you think about finding a relationship when you were... when you were looking at that one. That didn't cross my mind, actually. Although there's something definitely sexual.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, Gretchen, about when I was looking at the Thoughtspill one, I noticed that some of the drawings had words on them. Mm. The one I remember most is the bird with turbulence. And I just wondered how you see that relationship between the two things and where the words come in for you, and do you add those afterwards? And also, as I was thinking myself as a sort of viewer, how I might look at that and try and make a connection with myself. And I just wondered what's your perspective on that?
Well, the words do kind of tend to come. They'll either come afterwards or they'll sort of like come into my head as I'm making something. And with these drawings being kind of really quite immediate, the it'll kind of happen quite quickly. But with like the works don't always have words on them, so maybe in kind of like a larger piece of work, those words might become titles, or and I also kind of I collect phrases as well, so it's like in the same way that I kind of collects like resource images and stuff. So for example, it's like kind of a publication I brought out a few years ago was called Cats, Cold, Hunger and the Hostility of Birds. And that was actually just a fragment of a sentence that I had that I liked the sound of, and it was just like I kind of wrote it down and kind of kept it, and I have like lots of like books and boxes full of like just collected words. And so sometimes those inform an idea within the work, but sometimes I'll kind of marry them up with a drawing or with a body of work. And so it's, again, it's this process of kind of collecting and collaging and cross-referencing.
The collaging, I think, is correct, isn't it? Because there's I was thinking of a sort of Wittgensteinian idea of what can be said and what can be shown, you know, and that they both have agency and currency, and they're not equivalent to each other, and yet they have something of each other's proximity. You know, that's very nice. I mean, I'd like to make a slight connection to you and Una, because I think that there's the filmic, you know, that when you started to talk about the way that one goes through these drawings or sees all these drawings, or an audience might find a path through them, a bit like gaming, you know, you could make a choice, you go that way, and it's something filmic, like a filmic score where things gather pace and dissipate or seem to make sense or then drift off to a cul-de-sac, you know. Is that how your mind, are you almost gaming as you draw your way through these things?
I probably, like, in some ways I am, yeah, because I think visually, so I am, I guess I am just, like, sort of almost, like, kind of, like, rummaging through things in my mind and kind of taking, like, little avenues, and also, so, I mean, I'm also just, like, kind of, do find just, like, a lot of influence within film as well, so it's, like, within, so it's, like, kind of, so it's, like, sort of creating scenes, and, So, I guess in a way, I'm sort of, yeah, it's almost like a choose-your-own-adventure.
Yeah, it's just that yesterday someone came up with, I think it was you, said, when is it a game and when's it not a game? You know, these things are amusing and seductive and sort of voyeuristically intriguing, but then suddenly they bring you up short and then they're not anymore. That's not a game anymore. Oh, that's a bit too, you know, that story was a bit too real, that was a bit too pinchy at that moment.
So. Well, the game triggers off something, which is actually games of humour and playfulness, or obviously disguises, or actually vehicles of which to explore more sort of darker or more painful or more violent issues.
That's
right. You know, we're not reporters or documentary makers, we don't depict that, but you're in, you know, it's how can you... Usually you don't do it so consciously, but it's when you know and that's when the tension works. I like rummaging and collaging.
There was only a quick aside, actually, which was interesting that you should raise Wittgenstein, because again, a recent exhibition, one before Emma Talbot, Gavin Turk was here, and his exhibition, which again, most of it was actually called Wittgenstein's Dream.
Right.
And it was a conversation, as it were, between Wittgenstein and Freud and the study. So, you know, connections always.
Yes, well, yeah, good. But I think the word that you mentioned, the play work, I think one should just make a little mental mark next to that, because there's a big question about playfulness, and when is it playful, or when's it spiky and revengeful, or sadistic, you know, when's it not a game? I think this is very interesting. People are very accommodating about art and say, oh yes, you can make art about whatever you like and it's great liberal, but there are boundaries and there are transgressions, so it's clear. Can we hear from you, please?
Fine point, yes. So my name's Kira Nelson and I'm a doctor, psychiatrist, psychotherapist, and I'm a psychoanalyst, I trained at the British Institute. So the Freud Museum is very close to me, it's interesting when I sometimes think that I wanted to train as an analyst, partly because it's the closest to the arts you can get and still be a doctor. This was something about that. And that I work in a special secure unit for men with forensic personality disorder, sort of psychopaths, I suppose that you would say, in Hackney. And most of them have committed very severe, significant crimes, murder, rape, and that we work with them in what's called an adaptive therapeutic community to try and help people move on. But by doing that, they have to face the damage that they've done to others and themselves, and how to help the patients kind of develop their own narrative and to sort of be able to then build on that story when they get out. It doesn't always work, but that's kind of the aim. And I was thinking, you know, when I go and see somebody in a prison, say I'll get to the prison and I'll be given an hour and a half to 2 hours to assess someone. And I have documents as well, but I have to produce an assessment, which is a quite a neat document with that person's story. And then we make a decision, should they come in or not. But often I feel that when the patient does come, that the task is to kind of interrogate my story and work with the patient so that it becomes theirs, that they can own it. I remember a patient 26 years in a special hospital, and he was so stuck because he felt that in a way everything was being imposed on him. So he'd say, fuck your treatment. And it's just so interesting. And one day, thinking about the book, he used a rather clumsy metaphor, but he said, for a long time we were like books on a different shelf, and then one day we kind of got to the same shelf, and then we got to the same book, and now we're just a few lines away in the same page. And I thought it was an interesting that, and that, you know, the big thing for him, the change in his treatment was not, you know, I mean, of course he had a terrible background, he committed a very severe crime, but the changing point was when he allowed himself to be in alliance with me, and rather than battling, and when he could take on the story for himself, not just see me as somebody who was pushing it on him. And there's Spence, who's an American analyst, talks about the function of the analyst as the assistant autobiographer, and I quite like that. And that one of the problems in my field is that if you've got a pet theory, say about a particular type of trauma, you can seek it out and almost impose it on the person. And actually what you think is traumatic, they might not think so. And it's very interesting to ask patients at the end of treatment, what do you remember from this treatment? Because what I thought was, they, you know, thinking about the fragments, and I'm very interested in those kind of little moments of change. I was saying it in this today that when you work with people with schizophrenia, my patients at the moment don't, but I have worked with people with schizophrenia. And one of the characteristics of schizophrenia is a loss of the capacity to symbolise. So they don't understand metaphor, or because it all becomes very concrete. And a patient once said on a friend, and he said, oh, you know, doctor, when the young doctor comes and talks to me, and he asks me all about my life, and then he walks away, and then I'm left with a big hole in my stomach. And I said, oh, and it suddenly struck me, because we talk about taking a history, and I said, I think you feel he took your story away with him. His story, you know, that's what was it. And that we, and it made me, my teachings remind trainees and myself that when you do ask all these questions, and you know, perhaps it might be helpful to explain to the patient why you're asking, or what you think they might mean, and to, so that it isn't me taking his story away with me, but it's them, the patient's creating it. And that the importance, for me, that my way of conceptualising the work that we do with our guys is the conflict between creativity and destructiveness, and how to help men often who don't have a capacity to play. You know, we have to watch it on our unit. You know, sometimes something will start out as a game and it becomes, you know, play fighting quickly becomes fighting. And that capacity to have a bit of... we have art therapy, and we have a clay group, and we have reading group, and we also do projects making films. We've done two films so far. Filmmakers come in and very much worked with the men, and all in a way to try and help patients sort of think about themselves and others in a more creative way. You know, so a patient said to me, "Doctor, you know, I'm scum. Everyone knows I'm scum." And he, you know, committed a murder, committed a rape. And I said, I thought, well, our task is to try and work with the non-scum part of him. Not to excuse it, but to face it, actually. To not be escaping into drugs and alcohol and criminality, but really face it. And, you know, how do you help somebody face something, but also avoid shaming them? You know, I was thinking about the pieces below, the shaming...
The totems.
You know, how, for many of my patients, shame is a trigger for violence. So, always, how do you sort of hold with one hand and challenge with the other? And as Roy said, how do you hold with one hand and do surgery with the other? And the sort of narrative themes, or Freud also said many I can't remember where he said, the two things you need for a good enough life is love and work. And, you know, I feel that that's very much the sort of task with my patients, is to help. It doesn't just mean love in relationships, but perhaps having a friend. And what we've noticed is that the patients who seem to be able to develop a couple of friendships on the unit and keep, in a way then have a story together, do better. And some meaningful occupation doesn't have to be, you know, a lot of my guys are not going to get fully paid work. But we use more and more, we use people as experts by experience. So, which was unheard of when I started working in psychiatry. So, we bring the patients in to run some groups, to run the leave clinic. They do teaching on personality disorder. So, again, that sort of trying to work with in a playful way. And to kind of keep some, because, you know, so isn't it depressing, and it can be, and it's really hard work, and the patients behaved really badly on Monday and I was very cross with them, you know, and that but that they can also do very creative things, and one can sort of be a bit more playful. And I'll just end with the story. So a patient said to me, "Fuck off, you fucking fat cunt," and I went, "Fat?" For a moment he smiled, and it became something that could have been, you were talking about something that was really horrible, was transformed into something just a bit play. It was, you know, he shouldn't have said it, and I was cross, but it was also possible to make something a little bit creative with it. And I like those moments where, you know, they called it the mutative interpretation and analysis, but just occasionally you'll say something and you know it's really been heard, and that something's happened between the two of you that is very powerful and creative. And anyway, I was very honoured to be asked with real artists.
I was just thinking, Claire, that if you're invited to teach in art school, it might be too tame for you. Come on. Where are you?
Do you find that art therapy and talking therapy, is there a big division in terms of, can people have a faster access to themselves through art therapy and language, or that, you know, is there a kind of distinction between the two you found in your treatment?
Well, it's very interesting because our art therapist, she does an art therapy group, she does a clay group, but she also runs one of the small groups. So she does both. And that's quite interesting. I think it depends a bit on the person, but I really increasingly feel that that kind of transitional space or the third space with the art can be quite helpful in just, you know, the patient's beginning to then be able to use some of the other treatments a little bit more. And I supervise the art therapist, so, you know, I find it really interesting to hear about the pictures. And I try and encourage the patients to bring their pieces to clinical meetings, because sometimes they don't want to, they want it to stay in the space, in the art room. So, but that's very much dependent on them. I would do more if I could. And I say also, the only problem with art therapy is it's called art therapy.
Yeah.
And there's a big issue, I'm sure you know, but there's a big distinction between what's called an art group and an art therapy group. Because they, and say the clay group isn't a therapy group. And I get a bit muddled by that, because I think for the patients, sometimes they feel a bit, God, not all therapy. Because unlike many units...
Not all play.
Yeah. So, unlike many units, we have a very busy timetable. And we keep, you know, it's really important, again, the work thing. But that I sometimes... and that's one of the reasons the films have been quite good as well, that it's not therapy. Even so, I feel a bit disappointed that not more people get involved. But they're very... See our patients trying to work out where they'd like to go on leave. It can be very impoverished. I've got to go to Stratford to go shopping. Mare Street, you know, and it's actually the stories. Their stories can be very black and white, a bit bleak, a bit empty. And then you make a suggestion, they say, oh, doctor, why are you making all those middle-class suggestions? It might be fun, you know. You might enjoy it.
Maybe there's something interesting about the working with film, because you're working through a process. Mm. You're actually given a task to do. Yeah. It's like with artists, we set ourselves tasks. You have to file the etching plate or stretch things. You have to do this job, which is very mundane, but actually that's when, in inverted commas, the work or the play comes through, because you're busy doing something. Or I mean busy doing some method. So anything with a process, and the film is collaborative. You're given a job to do. So in a way, that stops you, I think, with all the work. It stops what I call the ideas coming from the back of your brain rather than like, given a blank piece of paper, it's terrifying. You have to, again, it's the, you have to destroy it or mark it or, you know.
No, I think that's, I think that's right. I think there's sort of, and for example, one of the youngest patients who's one of the most disruptive, but, you know, he won't go to many things. And one of the newer patients, I said, look, you've got to motor because you haven't got long till your discharge date. You've got to do as much as you can, and you're going to play group. Because sometimes you have to push a little bit. And anyway, he went off to the younger guy. He said, come to the play group with me. He said, but the younger guy likes playing chess. So he said, we'll make a chess episode together. And that's that, isn't it?
Yeah,
so, I really like that idea. So he doesn't have to come up with the
distractions and diversions.
I thought the patient there worked in a very helpful way and kind of, that was useful.
Direct as well, or maybe too intimidate. Art is intimidating as such. Whereas if you're doing, we're having a cutting workshop, or maybe not, we're having a collaging workshop.
But it's also
access point.
Yeah,
I think. It's,
yeah.
You
interesting. But it's really interesting what they do come up with, you know, because actually there is a creativity, and once people get used to it and to each other, they take more risks. And so, for example, a patient said recently, I want to try it with oils, which is a really hard meat. And it's all a bit of a mess, but that's okay, because he's somebody who's been a bit meticulous about things and thought making the mess with oil actually in itself was something. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's all right. All I was going to say is that the difference, as I see it, between, you know, making your own mark and kind of cutting out collage things, but also when you make your own mark, it's all you. You know, you are on the page, and it's what's that? Whereas if you cut something out, someone else has already done. Yeah. There's an intermediary, as it were, that's there that is much safer,
a lot less passion. Yeah. So I knew somebody in an art group that just made holes in the bits of paper, and that was because she thought that didn't say anything about her.
It brought up this idea, this kind of tyranny of the original, that there's this directive with, along with this word art, to be original, make something original, when ultimately it is all collage.
Are you going to go with that, Rachel?
I'm thinking about that.
let that one settle in a bit. I think I like the word tyranny there, because I'm slightly, when we're talking here about, you know, what's our story? How do we develop our story? Where is our story? How does one move from having a ready-made story, which you just adopt and fit into, and to actually owning something? I'm also reminded of sort of misspent times at art school and reading Jean Baudrillard, and everybody needs their own mythology, you know, and now there is a kind of tyranny around the mythology of art, so that I sometimes teach primary school pupils, and their teacher is always very pleased that I've come into the class because I'm a real artist and I'm going to teach them art, and it's a disaster. You want to say, please,
teach
physician, heal thyself, but we would like to say, we're going to learn how to use a pencil, or we're going to learn how to mix some colours. But you know, that's so disappointing. and it is a problem. But that thing that you say, Una, about stretching the canvas, or you're preparing the plate, this preparation thing, this ability to hold something and be with it for a period of time, to suspend the desire to achieve, to arrive, you know.
It's
so difficult.
We had a very nice afternoon just before Christmas of making Christmas decorations, the staff and patients together. And it doesn't, you know, and for about an hour and a half, it felt very nice and sort of collaborative. And I did this sort of thing with a cracker and stuff. And then, you know, but and one of the patients filched that for his room. It all has these meanings, but it doesn't always happen. But when it does, that does feel creative.
Yes. Mm. I must say that's how all my playthings got made, because I'm quite recent. I won't ever call myself a ceramicist, in having lessons, and the lessons were the best thing. You can only have like 3 hours, and you literally learned how to roll out a slab of clay. And the slab of clay became, you know, I made too many holes in it and it looked like a piece of cheese, so hence they became Joe's lunch. You learn how to make a slab pot look like it should have toes on, so it became toes and toast. You learn how to make a pinch pot. You put two pinch pots together, you know, it looked like a potato because it was so badly made. So I made, and that's literally how I think that trigger was fantastic. It released all sorts of things, loads of glasses.
I mean, that's where it's interesting where that term art comes in, when something is art, when you're putting pressure on it as art. Because my experience of like doing ceramics was kind of quite different, because I've got a small ceramics piece next door, and that came about through a residency that I did at Manchester Metropolitan University. And so I actually went into that context as an artist, and I was immediately like, I'm making art, and pressure of that has actually come quite huge, because I'm sort of faced with these materials that I'd got very little experience of, and it's just like I'm making art rather than I'm learning a process and seeing what's coming out of it. It's just like, right, you do art, go now. But I think it's just like that's a bit like the term art kind of means completely different things. It's sort of like to different people at different points as well, and that sort of emphasis that we put on it personally as artists is.
But isn't it also like when you say art, it kind of connects, at least for me, to articulate. And therefore, I think it's also the intense, for some, I mean, not for all, but for some, this intense fear of being exposed. I mean, it's the same as, you know, saying something now instead of not articulating. So, I don't know, like, that to me is art.
I mean, in a way, that's what art is to me as well, because I articulate myself much better through the images that I create than I really do with language. So it's just like there's a lot of things that I feel that I can explore and get across sort of through my work than I can through the spoken word.
Yeah, because I think that once you start to articulate, the I and the self is in it, and then it becomes your own. So, in working with patients, you know, when there are the thing about art therapy and people who fancy it and people who don't, I mean, it's quite logical, I would say, right?
It is, but what's different with the book of art is that, yes, you do articulate something that's yours, but then it gets given to an audience, doesn't it, or to the viewer, and they're going to make of it what they will, and that's quite
scary
actually.
Yeah. And it's something that you've got to be very aware of as an artist, and knowing that it gets to a point where it's going to go out into the world, so you're also kind of taking responsibility for this thing that you're going to share. So that is
That's the test. Any exhibition is a test. I think it's your testing a piece of work. One, whether it works physically, practically, aesthetically, also how it works with outside of your studio, let alone outside of your head. I don't think of it as art. I just think of it as making this.
I was just going to say something
about the way exhibitions are received in the museum as well, which is relevant to this, I think, in that I said at the beginning that often visitors are very sort of bewildered and can even be hostile to contemporary art here. But there's another strand, which we often find, is that actually visitors want to respond by being creative themselves and responding to the exhibition. So, for instance, with the recently Emma Talbot exhibition, which showed me some work, and as I said, it was called Unravel These Knots. And the education team set up, actually for a school group, a piece of work which was about making your own knots and on a piece of netting, and it kind of got left after the school group had gone, and actually we found that an awful lot of visitors were just beginning to start doing that anyway, and it actually took on a bit of a life of its own, because not only were people started to do knots, but then obviously some visitors who we don't know who had the idea of writing labels and tying those in with the knots. And on the labels then people started writing the knots in their own lives. And it sort of kind of developed, it's a momentum for itself, which hadn't been set as something to do, but became a way that visitors responded to the work in the exhibition.
So the image of that bridge in Paris with all the padlocks on comes to mind. You know, these things are double-edged. And very interested in this idea about the artist's intention. How does it work? Does it work or doesn't work? Does the audience, do you agree? I mean, this is the point where the question is to you.
I was thinking, so your title of thought, Skills, and that sort of has this, like, it's a suggestion of a leakage, like, maximum, it's something's going to go out without you really being sure how it's escaped. And I think that relationship as an artist with your work, where there's intention, certainly, but then through that creative process, for me, because I work as an artist as well, like, I want to have me go through this process of working for clearing the sad and making discoveries along the way. But in the end, the beautiful moment for me about making an artwork is when it sits over there and I'm just like, whoa, yeah. Who are you? Yeah. And it's a really, like, I learn a lot about myself through that process of making. So in terms of like intention and responsibility for putting a work into space, in some ways I feel like I have to take responsibility for my intention, which is this work, but I still feel so uncertain about whose responsibility the interpretation of the work is once it begins to talk in space. And particularly in somewhere like here where you are sort of, you know, that you're supposed to yourself when you want people to look at your work. You don't want to tie at the end, it's like you want people to be able to look at it in the same way, like I think of those like what and things spells, like what I learned about myself from looking at your work is really important as well. Like, you know, this is sort of a, and I was also thinking about that idea of connection with human when you're working with patients, and there's that moment of like you use the joke almost to feel like that friction and that vibration or something. And that's the potency, isn't it?
There's also, I was thinking what you, Rich, was saying, I think I said this to yesterday, that, you know, the first rule of psychoanalysis is pre-association, which is, and that's the point of lying on the couch, is so that you're not going to moderate what you say by looking at the expression in the therapy, in the analyst, and you just say what comes to your mind, and then the analyst, if they're doing their job well enough, begins to sort of create with you meaning. From the fragments, you know, not perhaps a full meaning, but something. And I remember when I was in analysis, and that the freedom of not having to directly address somebody. I loved being on the couch. I mean, it was just because it felt that I was, you know, because I'm somebody, for a doctor, that, you know, was always a bit, I'm very good at picking up what people are thinking and kind of, and to not have to do it. To just be able to say things was very, and then when the analyst helped me kind of get it a bit, again it was like, you know, that's a surprise. I didn't think that what I was saying was that. Yeah. Yes, I thought that was interesting.
That can be quite similar to kind of like the studio process, yeah, as well. Though it's like that that experience of having that, just like your studio time is your private time. So that's where you're actually kind of bringing these things like out of your mind and into like a physical reality, and yeah, and those moments where you, there's many moments like standing back and it's like, what have I just created? And like sometimes it might just sit there for months and you're still working it out. Or I mean, sometimes it's like there's some drawings and I still think it's just like, well, it means something to me, but I can't even explain it to myself. Yeah. But I think it's just like that process of kind of like sort of drawing it out and then kind of seeing it in front of you. It's just like, and then being able to read it and get to know it.
I worked in a therapeutic community called The Castle many years ago and had a patient, and she was an artist, and she couldn't bear it when I was moving. So she missed her last session, and then there was a tap at the door, and she left me a print saying to Dr. Van Wilson goodbye, you know, from. And I do have it up on my wall, and I thought about, should I take it, shouldn't I? But actually I thought she'd done it in a way that wasn't overly breaching a boundary. And I still remember, you know, in a way, okay, she couldn't manage the session, but she could manage that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that gave her that bit of extra space something else.
It was
very moving.
Hmm. But on the flip side, Dr. Van Vassen, how do we deal with the society which is so bent on revenge? And, I mean, we were talking very nicely about, you know, we put out our well-meaning efforts into the world and people respond or don't respond. But actually people respond with like, that's shit, let's get on to something. But how do we judge the Turner Prize? You know, why is one going to get the prize and the other not by that criteria? You know,
that's because, I mean, we're all driven by, you know, I know something about delinquency and a desire for vengeance, otherwise I wouldn't work with the guys that I do. Mm, mm. You know, I get it a bit, and my work is a way of sort of trying to manage that. And I just think that I don't know, I just feel that sort of striving to be more creative in whatever, I mean, that's going to sound pathetic. I just, you know, that the negative and the destructive inform us all. Because it's not just the men in my unit to commit murder. It doesn't take much, didn't take much for people in Rwanda to kill each other, you know, in mass numbers. Murderousness, rage, vengeance, desire are in all of us, not just in my patients.
You're a prophet politician.
And a prophetician. And, you know, great works of art have a capacity to reflect that.
Now I was just going to say civilization is intense.
Helen and Liz, we could leave it there. I think if we just come back to your very first comments, I think where you talked about the way in which the deepening of experience through stories, and we could say thanks very much to the Tall Tales curators for helping that happen. So, unless there's any more burning questions, I don't see any hands. That's kind of that. Maybe we can all come and meet the panel afterwards. No.
We could mingle.
Yes, we could mingle at two as well.